This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Lighthouse Faith Podcast, where we are moving forward in truth and love. I'm Lauren Green, Chief Religion Correspondent for Fox News Channel and author of the book Lighthouse Faith and the new devotional Light for Today. You know, the Bible states very clearly that God made humans male and female, but the Bible also says that because of the fall from grace, there is a brokenness in this world. And for many, gender ideology has become yet another example of our broken natures. Now, the push for gender-affirming care is a politically charged an ethically flimsy excuse for mutilating perfectly healthy young bodies. Gender ideology, the idea that you were born in the wrong sexual body, has pitted children against their parents, and even schools and state officials put pronoun preferences over parental rights. But the dark side of transgenderism is that those who realize they made the wrong decision and want to detransition, they are not as nearly supported, and their stories rarely receive accolades or their pain understood. But voices have begun speaking out, and detransitioners are having their day before Congress and in documentaries and books. And one book just released tells the story of five women and two men who, quote, once felt they were born in the wrong body. They believed the lie they were told by peers, teachers, and medical professionals that they could be their true selves by medically and surgically altering their bodies to match the opposite sex. And the book is called The Detransition Diaries. It's written by Jennifer Lall and Kaylee Fell. Fell is the executive director of the Center for Bioethics and Culture and Perinatal Nurse. Lall is the founder and former president of the Center for Bioethics and Culture. She is also an award-winning documentary maker, producing several films, including the one the book is based on, The Detransition Diaries, Saving Our Sisters. And Jennifer Lall joins me now. Welcome.
Great. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to be with you. You know, I'm just so fascinated by this book, and I'm fascinated because you're telling the stories. And what's really interesting is that you're telling the stories of eight people, but they are only representative. I mean, there are thousands out there probably in the same boat, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I say that this is just the tipping point. And there, if any of your listeners have followed the news, when these detransitioners speak out, they are viciously attacked. So there's many, many more detransitioners who don't dare to speak out because they see what will happen. So they just kind of quietly, happily, you know, detransition and try to get back with their life.
How do you detransition if you've had a mastectomy? You know, and you have taken hormones for several years that permanently alter your body.
Yes, and there are many lifelong negative complications of transitioning, and I use transitioning lightly because I don't believe you can become the opposite sex through medicine or through surgeries. But what overwhelmingly these people do is they immediately stop taking the wrong sex hormone. So women stop taking high-dose testosterone, men stop taking high-dose estrogen. They reclaim their birth name. They reject the pronouns. Perhaps they had, you know, adopted they, them, or, you know, Zezer. You know, they go back to their natal sex, you know, with he, him, she. They dress as the sex that they were born. But for those that have medicalized, you know, we talk about Chloe Cole in the book. One of her stories is her. And I'm in California, and Chloe is in California, and she's actually suing Kaiser Permanente because as a young teenager, she had a double mastectomy. Now, you know, Grace also in the book had a double mastectomy. You know, those are permanent surgical interventions. Yes, perhaps you can have breast reconstructive surgery, but as they say in their story, their insurance doesn't cover that. Their insurance covers their healthy breasts removed, but not reconstructive of their double mastectomies. And when you think of a mastectomy done in transition medicine, It's very different than a mastectomy a woman who has breast cancer has. You know, in a previous life, I was a nurse. And, you know, when you have a cancer and you have to have a mastectomy, you know, they remove as little as possible of the breast tissue and the lymphatic. In transition medicine, the mastectomy actually involves bone shaping. You know, they're trying to masculinize the chest.
Oh my gosh.
And the milk glands are forever removed. So these women, even if they have reconstructive surgery, will never be able to breastfeed their children. And Grace has just become a mom. And she talks about on social media, you know, she laments the fact that she was able to conceive and have a healthy baby, but she can't nurse her baby.
How did this thing get started, and how did it infiltrate the medical profession so that they would even do this? I mean, isn't the first rule do no harm?
Yes, it really is. And we begin in the first chapter of the book, The Detransition Diaries, with a reflection back on certain points in time where medicine lost its way. And we begin with what happened in Nazi Germany and what was, you know, culminated in the Nuremberg trials, when the world realized the heinous medical experimentation and abuses on, you know, those that were interned in Nazi Germany and around that area. Then we look at the lobotomy studies, which, you know, physicians were doing these horrific, you know, irreparable damage surgeries to people's brains. We look at the Tuskegee studies, another area where medicine did not act ethically. And then we kind of culminate with looking at the mass involuntary sterilization movement across the United States, where medicine decided who was fit to reproduce and who wasn't. And so we sort of point to the fact that medicine has a tendency. You know, you opened with, you know, the fallenness of the world. You know, medicine is not, you know, protected from our fallen sinful nature. And, you know, it's always through activism, education, lawsuits, whistleblowers. And we've seen that in the news this last week with what's happened in the United Kingdom, that they've ruled now we're not going to block puberty on young children. We just celebrated Detransition Awareness Day, raising the temperature of the awareness of these people that have huge regret. And, you know, medicine is not, you know, protected from being captured by the ideas of the day. And so it is our effort through our filmmaking and through this book and with everybody else that's working in this space to call medicine to account.
But one of the things that's so apparent, though, I mean, you do give the history of this path towards gender ideology and taking off and it being affirmed by the medical professions. But I don't understand, like, how did it just take off by a wildfire, like in the last maybe decade? I mean, how did it just go from, you know, few experiments to all of a sudden it's just exploded?
Well, I think a couple of things, you know, I can't prove this, but in my research and my study, you know, it was all of the major institutions were captured. So we saw it happen in universities. We went from having women's studies to gender studies to queer studies, and this blurring of the distinction between we were made male or female. And, you know, part of that is just in the efforts to give women equal access, you know, to equal rights. But it got distorted into now we don't even have the language to say male and female anymore, because there's non-binary and gender fluid and, you know, demisexual and all these categories. So we blurred the biology. You know, you work in media. We've seen it in media and just in the, you know, the style language that journalists have to report, where they have to refer to Caitlyn Jenner as a woman versus, you know, I know Caitlyn Jenner is a man.
Right.
You know, it's been captured in all of the major institutions across the country. And underlying that is, you know, certainly there's money to be had. You know, there's money to be made. These are very expensive surgeries and procedures and medications. And as the detransitioners say, they're patients for life. So they will constantly be needing the help of the medical establishment to try to repair and get their body functioning as healthily as possible.
You know, one of the things I've seen, because I cover religion, I'm a faith, person of faith, but I have also seen that there is a huge rise in the people who are sort of losing their religion, losing not just their faith in, because everybody's got faith in something, but what they're losing it is an organized religion, because an organized religion has authority. They don't want to be associated with an authority over their spirituality. And so what you lose in that is an objective source of ethics, of morality. You don't have that connection to an objective source, which, you know, really comes from religion, you know, the doctrines, the theology. And so here you've got this exponential rise in gender ideology, and the misnomer of gender affirming care, at the same time. Can you relate these two together? Because it seems it's, I know it seems anecdotal, maybe I'm just making it up, but I do think that there's a connection here.
Well, obviously there's a connection, and it's really hard to make an argument for the fact that we can change sex or, you know, become something that we were never meant to be without any kind of, you know, roots in truth. Some people reconcile that with just, you know, I think of Colin Wright and the work of Colin Wright, who's an avowed atheist, but recognizes, you know, the biology of species, and that you cannot take a man and change him into a woman. I actually do see a lot of stories, because I follow detransitioners online, of detransitioners who have converted to faith as part of their detransition, in realizing that, you know, hope, you know, power, love, whatever comes from, you know, this belief in a higher power, or you know, a God, a supreme God, the, you know, the true, you know, creator of all of us and all of creation. So I see parents who have quietly maybe left their faith, you know, through their young adult and into their early, you know, adult life, who are coming back to their faith because there's meaning in that. When you look at the world now and in the transgender debate, it's chaotic. There's no bottom to where this ends. You know, a lot of people are worried that this is, you know, just ushering in the transhumanism movement. No longer will we try to become the opposite sex, but we will try to become another being that isn't even human anymore. And so I think when you have this kind of chaos, people are looking for truth. Now, whether that's in the form of organized religion, because there's certainly many organized religions out there that are woke and are captured and proudly hang the trans flag outside of their religious, you know, establishments, and fly them proudly throughout the week.
They
And I
have
don't
lost
know
their
if
way. I want to be on record. They have lost their way if they don't
Yes.
affirm the Bible's understanding that there are two genders. I mean, any church that hangs that kind of flag out is just lost.
I would agree.
I just had to interject that. That's because it's just, I've
Yeah.
gotten really angry about that. One of the things, I want to go through some of these stories because, first of all, is there a common thread through the detransition stories? Is there a common path that they all took, or you know, at some point?
Absolutely. There's themes of these are young adults that are have had some kind of trauma in their life. Whether it be bullying, whether it be broken home, whether it be abusive, you know, sexually abusive experiences, there's been some kind of a trauma. Internet use, you know, extreme internet use that's led them into rabbit holes of extreme pornography. You know, our young adults today have way too much access to things on the internet that young children have no discernment. They can't. You know, they can't understand this is evil, this is wrong, you know, run, shut it down. So those are themes. Autism, you know, whether it be OCD on the spectrum, Asperger's, you know, there's that kind of a theme. There's two different things that sort of separate male detransitioners from female. And one of the things we tease out in our most recent film, The Lost Boys, Searching for Manhood, which focuses only on the young men, is this all the messaging that men hear, you know, rape culture, the patriarchy, misogyny, toxic masculinity, you know, they're sort of steeped in this, you know, men are bad. And then when puberty hits, they go, oh my gosh, I don't want to become a rapist. I don't want to become, you know, that guy. And where young girls are more social creatures. So there's more of that social contagion. If Susie and Debbie are dressing this way and wearing their hair this way, I need to do that. If they're changing their pronouns, I need to do that because I want to be in the pack, in the in crowd. So those are kind of two areas where boys and girls, young men and women are a little bit different. But overwhelmingly, these young adults have serious comorbidities that are not being addressed through good counseling and psychiatric care.
I think that's one of the scary things. If you're a parent out there, it's a scary thing that if your child is suffering from some kind of depression and you take them to a counselor and the counselor starts talking about taking puberty blockers, I mean, can a parent interject and say no and say you're not acting properly? I mean, why is the first care for my child puberty blockers? Why not, you know, find out what's wrong with her mentally? You know, there's a mental health issue here, right?
Right. And, you know, it's wonderful because parents have organized, there's many great organized support groups in the United States in particular that are, you know, helping parents navigate this. And there's great tools out there. Like first, if you're going to bring your child to a counselor, find out what kind of counselor there are and ask things like, you know, what kind of books do you recommend I read? And that will be a red flag if they ask you, have you read like pro-affirming kind of books. What do you think about pronouns? And should I, you know, if they say, oh, absolutely, you need to adopt your child's new pronouns and call them by their new name. You know, those are red flags to first find a counselor that's going to really work with you and find out what's really going on with your child and get dealing with those kind of issues. So I think, you know, parents who are listening right now, you know, they can message me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, Jennifer Lall, and I can point them to the different organized parent groups because they have resources, they have experience, and they can help, you know, walk you through this trial.
You know, one of the things, I want to go back to the issue of trauma, because I know a lot of people, when they listen to the word trauma, they think, oh, my child hasn't gone through trauma. Well, the case of Helena is, it's trauma, but it's not a trauma that a parent would recognize. She had a loss of a primary caregiver when she was young, and it devastated her, but the parents didn't talk about it. Isn't it possible, and parents should understand, that a trauma to a child may not seem like a trauma to an adult?
Yeah. And, you know, we have to put ourselves in our young children's shoes. I mean, you know, divorce is a trauma to children. And sometimes as adults, we don't want to address the fact that we, through, you know, divorcing our spouse, have caused trauma to our children. You know, parents have to be the adults in the room. Parents have to be first looking out for the best interests of their own children, because we know and love our children more than anybody else could know and love them. And that was exactly Helena's case. And you think back on her story, if only at that time when she lost that caregiver that she loved and, you know, adored, was able to process that, whether it be through her family or whether her family, who couldn't, you know, help her process that for whatever reason, they didn't want to talk about it, you know, get her, you know, help, you know, so she could process it with a therapist or something, or a priest or a pastor.
I mean, she was dealing with this all through her elementary school years. And then finally, during puberty, which is a lot when these things start to happen and the hormones come in and the body changes, that's when that hit, right? I mean, it hit at this time, like, I don't want my body to change. I don't want to grow up. I don't want to have, you know, hair in places I've never had it. These are traumas that, unless you help a child understand the process, they're going to incorporate their childhood traumas, now just become exacerbated and exponentially worse during puberty. Is this kind of how this kind of thing happens and develops?
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of that harmonic convergence. You know, many of us can recall being adolescents and how awkward and how challenging that was. Our body's doing all kinds of goofy things. You know, little boys, their voices are cracking. You know, you're getting body hair, you're getting acne. You know, your body's doing all kinds of things you feel uncomfortable with. But now this is at a time when children are spending way too much time on the internet. Right. We have all these influencers on what you should look like. And you hear these messages, well, if you don't like your body, you're probably born in the wrong one. And they kind of go, oh, okay, I don't like my body. I don't like that I'm getting breasts. I don't like that I'm getting hair and here over there. Maybe I am born in the wrong body. So I think there's these things that are kind of coming together. And, you know, what part of Helena's story, which I think is important, too, because it's the climate that we live in now. You know, she was from a upper middle class educated white home.
Mm-hmm.
So she's on the internet and she's already told that she's part of the problem, you know, because she's a privileged cis white girl. So she found out early on, if she changed her pronouns, she got more social credit.
Wow.
Then she changed her name. She got more social credit. She was no longer this white oppressor from a privileged home. She was, you know, could level the playing field. So this is all coming at a time, again, when children are lacking the discernment, the maturity to navigate what otherwise puberty has been with us since the beginning of time. And we've all had to navigate this. And we've, up until now, we've been able to navigate it without permanently destroying and ruining our body.
I want to take a break right now on Lighthouse Faith Podcast and come back to Jennifer Lahl talking about the detransition diaries. We'll be right back.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
We're back with Jennifer Lahl. She is the co-writer and co-author of the book, The Transition Diaries, but also the documentaries. And before we got started, Jennifer, you talked about that this was part of a trio of documentaries, right?
Yes, yes. The first film we produced was called Transmission, What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? And we interviewed parents, a couple of detransitioners, and mostly medical experts on both sides of the debate that are pro-affirming and against that. Then we quickly, because we saw audiences really resonated with the voices of the detransitioners, at the same time, Leslie Stahl had just done her 60 Minutes episode that actually included Grace in that episode, and the backlash that 60 Minutes received from how dare you include the detransitioners stories,
wow.
We thought, oh, we're going to make the detransition diaries. And we focused intentionally only on women because we wanted to just laser in on what's going on with young girls today. And then when that film came out, Ignatius Press came and said, will you write the book? And we said, sure. And we were in production then for The Lost Boys on men, because when the detransition diaries came out, all the parents that had young men came in the droves and said, please tell the stories of our sons and our boys. And we can never say no when we have, you know, somebody's cry of their heart. And, you know, I'm not trying to sell my movies. They're all free on our YouTube channel, so people can watch them if they want. But yeah, so we have three films and now the book. And the book is great because you can sort of flesh out bigger ideas, like the history of the movement. How did we get here? How will we make our way back? How will we get out of this? You know, we're no longer doing Holocaust style experimentations on, you know, incarcerated people. We're not permanently sterilizing people against their wishes. We've stopped doing it. So how will we stop this dark point in history right now?
Well, I mean, speaking of from just a religious point of view, the devil has figured out a way for, you know, for to stop the crazies, but then to actually infiltrate regular people to say, I want it now. You know, you don't have to, you know, use experiments on, you know, inmates and death row inmates and, you know, Nazi camp, you know, inmates. I mean, it's like you've infiltrated the mind and said, no, I'm going to do this because I feel uncomfortable in my body. Now, you talk about the backlash that even 60 Minutes got with the segment on detransitioners. But what is the percentage, do we know, of people who have had gender altering surgery and want to detransition? Do we know the percentage?
We don't, because, you know, that saying, what doesn't count doesn't get counted.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no official tracking. You know, a lot of detransitioners don't go back to their physician who did bottom surgery or double mastectomies and say, oh, I wanted you to know I'm no longer him. I'm back to my natal sex.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't self-report and there's no central tracking. What we do know is, like, there is a, for example, and I'm not recommending Reddit because there's a lot of nasty stuff going on Reddit, but there is a detransition subreddit group. And that, you know, started out pretty small, hundreds, thousands, and now it's, you know, over 75,000 people in that group. And you have to be a detransitioner to be in that group. You know, I can't be an active member in that group. I can kind of lurk and see what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I think the numbers are just much higher. Again, I said at the outset, this is just the tipping point. And courage begets courage. You know, as more detransitioners do speak out, more and more are emboldened too, but there are still people that say, you know, no, thank you. I don't want to be, you know, the whipping boy that's, you know, attacked online or you know, people worry about losing their jobs. You know, people worry about their family being caught up in the ugliness of the transgender debate.
I think that's one thing where I see it more often is that there are people of faith, parents of faith, and they're blindsided by their child deciding that they want to be called by the opposite pronouns, or they want to, or they're going by a different name in the school, and the school has not informed them. Of course, they get the information very late. And when they start to try to fight back, there is no recourse for them. Even the law is against them. I think one case in Indiana last fall, the state actually took the child away from the parents because of the child's wish to be called by another pronouns, and they've assigned him or her, I don't know what it was, a caretaker family, a foster family. If you're a person of faith, have you seen that people of faith get worse treated than just, you know, the regular secular kind of family?
I haven't seen that. I've seen just across the board, parents, whether they be of a religious faith or not, are concerned, rightly so, for losing their own children if they do not affirm. There's two particular cases in California. Both are fathers who will not affirm that their sons are girls, who have lost custody. One particular father, Ted Hudako, he has two sons, and the judge did not take away custody or rights or visitation to his one son, who thinks he's a boy and is a boy. But his son that he won't affirm, he has not seen his son for over 3 years. And you kind of have to say, well, why he can see one father and one son? He's clearly not a bad father.
Right,
he's not,
right.
You know, putting his children. So I haven't seen that it plays harder for religious people. I just see across the board, and parents are rightly concerned about that, because there are people that are having their children removed from their care.
And how can they fight back? I mean, what's the legal recourse for a parent who is getting their child taken away from them over this issue of gender ideology?
Yeah, well, you know, they have to lawyer up. I mean, the legal fees that a lot of these people, I'm again referring back to Ted Hodako's case, you know, he's constantly, you know, asking people to help, you know, chip in to keep moving his case forward. There, you know, Harmeet Dhillon, who perhaps you know, her group is over Chloe Cole's case. You know, there's a new group of lawyers down in Texas that have all intentionally left their lucrative law practices to come together to solely fight for these kind of cases, whether it be custody battles, whether it be detransitioners who were suing because, you know, they were not told that this was going to permanently ruin their lives. So, I mean, it really is. It's an uphill battle, because we know that fighting the courts is, you know, the courts have been infected. I was a court watcher on several hearings with Ted Hudako's case, mm-hmm. and the judge opens the hearing by saying his name, and then he follows it with, "And my pronouns are." And when you're sitting in a courtroom listening to a hearing where the judge is identifying his pronouns, you already feel like, well, we don't have a fighting chance here.
How can science, though, affirm this? I mean, we're talking about the first documentary you did, and you had scientific minds on both sides. What stymies me is the fact that a scientist can say the mind is the determinant of your sex, when clearly it is not. I mean, what is the argument on the side of affirming transgenderism that someone's born in the wrong body? What's their argument?
It's pretty weak and pretty shaky. I interviewed for our film Transmission, Michelle Forcier, who was also later followed up in Matt Walsh's film, What is a Woman? She became known as the Chicken Woman. Mm. And there's sometimes when I just need to be reminded how crazy their arguments is, I will go back and watch the whole footage of that interview. Now, all the footage that I shot with Dr. Forcier didn't make it into the film. And I kept pressing her because she kept saying, there's nothing wrong with these kids. They know that they're not born in this body and they're not that sex. And they're on their gender journey and they're driving the car. And that's really hard for parents because parents have to sit in the back seat while their child drives, you know, the car. And we're going to let them pause their puberty with puberty blockers. And I kept pressing her because I said, if there's nothing wrong with these children, you're saying there's nothing wrong with these children, why are you putting them on medication? Because I know as a nurse, we don't tell people to take medicine if there's no medical need.
Right, right.
We're just buying them time. So we're pausing their puberty to buy them time to sort things out. And it's like, why do we have to buy them time? Why can't we get them the care that they need now to help sort themselves out, whether that be psychiatric care or counseling, or just leave them be because this is normal. They're feeling normal things, mm-hmm. puberty. And she really got wrapped around the axle because, again, there's no logic. There's no bottom to it.
Yeah, there's no medical test for transgenderism, right? Or gender dysphoria. There's no test. There's no DNA test.
There's no disease. If there's an illness, it's a medical illness.
Right, right.
You know, because of trauma, because of comorbidities. You know? And then we would address the medical issue through counseling, psychiatry, those kind of things that medicine can offer, not by cutting off their breasts.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I want to know... You know, you're talking about, you know, what kids are going through during puberty. And I remember going through puberty. I remember health class during puberty. And I remember in certain health classes, in certain schools, they would actually separate the girls from the boys so they could talk a little bit more intimately about what their bodies would be going through and this transition to help them in this process. Are there no health classes in school anymore that do that? Or is that sort of nothing that happens in schools today?
I mean, unfortunately, in schools, that's the worst setting these children find themselves in. They can't even, you know, little girls can't even be guaranteed when they go to the bathroom in public school that they won't have little boys in the bathroom with them. You know, there's this no need to separate the sexes anymore. So we can have boundaries and truly safe spaces where little girls can ask awkward questions about why are my breasts doing this? Mm-hmm, or why does she have her period and I don't have my period yet? Is there something wrong with me? Or, you know, those kind of questions. Little boys, why do I wake up in the middle of the night with an erection? I never used to have this problem.
Yeah.
Sorry, that might be a little TMI.
No, but I'm just saying that this is, you know, God made our bodies in a certain way. I mean, this is a natural part of growing up. And there's no, it used to be the school was supportive of those kinds of transitions to help young people in that transition from childhood to adulthood or young adulthood. And that doesn't exist anymore. But I want to get, before we go, I want to get to, because we've been talking a lot about in the news about biological men playing in women's sports. So the idea is that it seems as though more men are doing this, but the actual numbers, you say that the trend of wanting to change their sex is higher among young girls. Is that true? And why?
It's true because of what they call the social contagion factor, which is girls are more influenced by what their peer group of other girls are doing. And so they tend to adopt, well, if they're doing it, I should do it because I want to fit in. Mm-hmm. I want to be one of the cool kids. I want to have friends.
So that's basically the reason. And then men who want to transition, what's their kind of underlying principle socially? I mean, not just, you know, the things in the household or whatever, but socially, what's their ideas behind wanting to transition? Like, you know, this that Leah Thomas, who thinks he's a woman because, you know, I don't know, because he wants to be a better swimmer or win awards. I don't know. But what would be his motivation?
Well, I think he would be different than what we're seeing happening in, say, pre-adolescent and adolescent boys. You know, the Leah Thompsons, you know, these are people that I think have a mental health issue, whether it be, it's called autogynephilia, which is probably what, you know, people in the White House administration have, where they feel a sense of sexual excitement by pretending, putting on a woman face, you know, mm-hmm. acting as if they're women. I think it's, you know, it is misogynistic. It's hatred toward women. You know, that we're going to, California, where I live, we have a huge problem with men in women's prisons. We have several hundred that, you know, Gavin Newsom has decided it's a good idea if you just defy. And these are men that have never had any kind of surgery. So these are fully intact adult men who are in prison because they have histories of violence. And often that's been abusive violence toward women who are now. And is that a power struggle? Is it, I think it's a lot of that, which is different, again, from the young men mm-hmm. that have this, you know, they've just been raised in this environment where men are bad, men are bad, men are bad. And, well, you know, these messages.
This is fascinating. And I want to encourage people to look at the documentaries. Jennifer, what are the documentaries and where they can find them?
The first one is Transmission. What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? Then there's the Detransition Diaries, Saving Our Sisters. And most recently, we launched The Lost Boys, Searching for Manhood. Those are all on the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network YouTube channel, free to watch. And then the book, The Detransition Diaries, is available through Ignatius Press, the publisher, or people can get it on Amazon.
Great. I want to thank you so much. This has really been eye-opening, and I hope that more people really are armed with really great information about what's going on out there about gender ideology and the absolute travesty of language gender-affirming care. So I just want to thank you so much for being on Lighthouse Faith Podcast. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for listening to Lighthouse Faith Podcast. I'm Lauren Green. Have a blessed day. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. Amazon Prime members can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music app, or just hit the follow button on your favorite podcast player.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.